You're listening to White Atlantic Weird, the Irish 14 show that's critical but not cynical. This is Cian, and as always, I'm somewhere in the vicinity of the cabin in the woods located somewhere in rural Ireland, and you find me in the middle of winter. It's cold, it's dark, it's the middle of the night, and perfect conditions for astronomy. I've got the old telescope out, I've set it up in front of the cabin, pointing up through the treetops and looking out, and my drink for this episode, keeping me somewhat warm beside me, is a very small amount of Busker whiskey. This is Busker single pot made in Royal Oak outside Bagnallstown in County Carlow. And why am I out here looking at the stars? Because this episode is all about H.P. Lovecraft and astronomy. My guest for this one, you could probably guess, is the tremendous Eddie Guillemont, always welcome on the pod. And I haven't done any recording in a long time just because life has been like that. It is likely to continue being like that for some time. I'm choosing my themes and my episodes very carefully because it takes a lot of effort to get the time, to carve the time out to do the recording, do the reading, and get the editing done as well. So being a little bit fussier than I used to be about what I do, but I do have a few fun episodes in the can. They'll probably come out more slowly than they used to, but that's just how life is. As always, you can say hi over on the socials. I'm on Mastodon, where I'm at White Atlantic Weird at mastodon.social, and on Instagram, where you can see my travels, my outdoor adventures, and even my occasional obsession with identifying fungi. You can see me there over at where I'm white underscore Atlantic underscore weird. And I'd like to say a quick thank you to Laura, known as the Long Arm of Coincidence on Instagram, for sending a few coffees my way. So that's over on buymeacoffee.com/White Atlantic. Huge thanks to Laura. Sent a whole bunch of coffees, actually. So if you want to support the show in any little way like that, that's a very simple thing that you can do. Okay, what am I reading at the moment? I'm reading two things that might be of interest. Number one is Robert E. Howard's Heroes in the Wind. And this is a collection of Robert E. Howard short stories. I never read a whole lot of Howard and over the years, and the stuff that I did, well, certainly compared to Lovecraft, the stuff that I did read was not his most famous stuff, which is Conan. I've read a lot of Solomon Kane and other bits and pieces. I find him interesting rather than good or enjoyable. I think it's kind of like important to understand his place in the history of weird fiction, because he's like the in-between slot between, you know, your Edgar Rice Burroughs and then your sort of modern ideas of fantasy that come from like Gary Gygax and Dungeons and Dragons. He was, I think anyway, far more influenced by Robert E. Howard than he was by Tolkien, even though we kind of think that Tolkien is the be-all and end-all of modern fantasy. But some very important and very American strands of high fantasy, I think, take a lot more from Howard than they do from Conan. Not to say that I enjoy Howard tremendously, but having finally read a bit of Conan, it is better than the other stuff. I kind of get it. I will say, as I've always thought about Howard, he is way, way more obsessed with race than even Lovecraft was. And I know that everybody, when we talk about Lovecraft, we talk about his racism, rightly so. But wow, it's built into, it's baked into Howard's work in ways that are much more fundamental, I think, even than Lovecraft's ideas about race. I'm also reading Greg Grandin's Fordlandia, The Rise and Fall of Henry Ford's Forgotten Jungle City. This is a real Cian book. This is about Henry Ford in the 1920s trying to build a small American city in the middle of the Amazon so that he can have a colony for a rubber plantation, basically, for making rubber for tires. And a lot of it's about Henry Ford's very strange ideas. He was a very bad dude. He's getting high up on my list of all-time high bad dudes. But Jungle Adventures in the Early 20th Century, I can't say no to. And honestly, this story of like a weird pseudo small American town built in the Amazon is giving me flashbacks to an occasion when I worked in Panama many, many years ago in a small pseudo colonial town, which had been I think built for and by the US Navy when they controlled the canal zone in Panama. But me showing up about 100 years later, the look of the town was very kind of 1930s American, Latin American quasi-colonial stuff. So very, very much Cian stuff there. Okay, that's enough ins and outs. We're going to get started. You're going to have a listen to myself talking to Eddie Guillemont, and I'm going to see if I can warm myself up enough and warm my fingers enough to twiddle the dials here and get going on this here telescope. So hope you enjoy it.
We are certain that Satanism exists. It's the practice of evil.
And following closely behind this car was this unidentified flying object.
You will prove the existence of the Bigfoot or Sasquatch by bringing in a body.
I'm assuming many longtime listeners will probably be familiar, but yeah, my name's Eddie Guimont. I'm assistant professor of history at Bristol Community College in Fall River, Massachusetts, and I am now a co-author with Professor Horace Smith of Michigan State University of the book When the Stars Are Right, H.P. Lovecraft and Astronomy, out now from Hippocampus Press, Hippocampus Press in New York, but spiritually right over in Providence, Rhode Island.
Fantastic. Yes. And I'm a little bit late to this, Eddie, because the book came out in the summer just past, and I was waiting to get a physical copy because I love physical copies. I wanted to hold this book in my hand, and I did have had arranged for a copy to be brought over to me from North America, and that fell through. So I'm going to be waiting a little bit longer. And as such, I have been reading the digital version so we can have this conversation. But this is a tremendously enjoyable book, and I'm going to be giving lengthy recommendations to listeners. I genuinely think that folks who've been listening for this long, and especially to our own conversations and who've kept up with your work, are going to love this. So, yeah, tell us what the book is about, Eddie.
So for many people who are familiar with me, I'm a historian by trade, and I've kind of drifted into the historian of the esoteric side. But my co-author and astronomer, both of us are fans of Lovecraft. Both of us actually are originally from the state of Connecticut, which is how we got in touch. Horace reached out to me several years ago now about some work I had done on Lovecraft's connection to Connecticut, some of which comes out in this book. But for a long time, I've been having loose ideas for a book about Lovecraft and his connections with space opera, kind of the early 1920s, 1930s pulp science fiction, E.E. Doc Smith, early Heinlein, the idea of, astronauts with, big muscles flying around in spaceships, beating up, the evil Martians and that. So you tend to think of a lot of, Lovecraft as a influence on fantasy, horror, or emblematic of these. And a lot of times you get science fiction there as well, but you don't really get space opera, exploration. Even though he writes a lot about aliens, it's typically the aliens coming to Earth. I was kind of interested in exploring this blank spot in the Lovecraftian historiography about his connections to and his influence on the space opera genre. And so this, obviously there's a lot of astronomical knowledge that is part of that, especially in Lovecraft's lifetime. Horace, as an astronomer, very interested in Lovecraft's connections to astronomy, his interest in astronomy, his role as an amateur astronomer. So we got talking and we decided, probably would make sense for us to combine both our efforts into a single book. And so that was around 4 years ago now, and now the book is out. So the book's divided up between different chapters. Horace took the more astronomical focused ones. I took maybe a bit more of the literary studies, but we co-edited each other's chapters. We contributed ideas. So even though we kind of each had primary areas we focused on, it is very much a collaboration throughout. And so we're able to really look at not just Lovecraft's interest in astronomy throughout his life, but how astronomy as a field evolves during Lovecraft's lifetime, how these ideas are connected with changing fiction, dealing with space, dealing with space exploration, how Lovecraft in turn fits in with this, how his fiction, even from an early time, is building off some of whom are, were at the time very well known and now forgotten, some of whom are still kind of well remembered, both astronomers and science fiction authors, and the legacy of Lovecraft in the science fiction, specifically, space opera, but some science fiction in general, since his death up until relatively recently. I think the most recent thing we talk about is a story from 2021-22, so fairly recently. So if you're interested in kind of the more nonfiction side, if you're interested in the fiction side. You know, if you're interested in biography of Lovecraft, a history of science fiction, there's something for everyone. So really, I have to say, if any of your interests fit any of those fields, you should definitely go buy the book now. Maybe buy two copies just to make sure.
So listeners, if you're wondering whether this is something worth getting, it absolutely is. And I know that people who like the show are going to find loads of stuff here. For me, it was, I'm a minor league astronomy person. I did have an interest as a younger man. But yeah, the way in which you guys place his work within the grander pantheon of science fiction classics was astonishing to me. And there were, you would bring up authors and I'm wondering, like, how are they going to work this into, you know, Lovecraft's work? Because I wasn't aware that it had been as influential as it had. And so the connections to Jules Verne, the connections to H.G. Wells, the connections to Burroughs, you know, and then you've got Werner von Braun and you've got Willy Ley and all these like well-known astronomers and astronomy writers. So we've got loads of different directions to take this. I don't even know where to start. But how about this? The astronomy that existed in Lovecraft's day, what was it like? How is it different to how we see the universe today?
So Lovecraft's lived in a period where really, I mean, you can say modern astronomy, along with modern notions of physics, really emerged during his life. I mean, you asked about how Lovecraft, or how like the view of the universe changed during Lovecraft's lifetime. I mean, the universe as we understand it today is a concept that emerges during Lovecraft's lifetime, when Lovecraft was born, and during his early years when he's very interested in amateur astronomy, in astronomy textbooks of the late 19th century. The Milky Way galaxy is it. That's the limit of the galaxy. That is the limit of the universe. It's during Lovecraft's lifetime that other galaxies are determined, that it's not just our galaxy, that the universe is expanding, that Einstein's theory of relativity, you know, is discovered, which Lovecraft also has kind of a complicated relationship with that. This is the era of attempts, you know, to chart the Martian canals on Mars. This is a period of huge discoveries of moons of Jupiter, obviously the planet, or the ex-planet Pluto, maybe just out of deference to Lovecraft, we'll call it the planet Pluto, is discovered. Ideas about, you know, an innermost planet, Vulcan, are finally disproven. So much of kind of the modern conceptions of astronomy, the, you know, the frontiers of science, of astronomy, really expand dramatically during his lifetime. And as someone who, even after he kind of stops, you know, closely following a lot of these developments as he had when he was a teenager, he still is very interested in all of this. I mean, we have this one letter from, I think, 1920-21, where he's talking, you know, just casually with his friends about, you know, efforts to find a planet beyond Neptune, efforts to, you know, design a rocket to reach the moon, efforts to, discovering a new moon of Neptune. So these are all things that are just in the news that anyone, you know, at any point could pick up, you know, a copy of, you know, say the New York Times, read about some new, you know, planet potentially being discovered, read about some new theory of physics that, you know, changes how, you know, orbits are calculated. This is, you know, very much a dynamic period of change. Lovecraft is very interested, even if, you know, by his own admission, he doesn't always understand and sometimes doesn't always expect or accept them. He is very interested in all of these new developments.
And he's from a very young age, he's very serious about this. As a teenager, he's writing columns in local papers about astronomy, and he's producing his own astronomical sort of fanzines, isn't he?
Yeah, he's writing an astronomy column for kind of like a second-rate local newspaper in Rhode Island, maybe mainly because the main, you know, Rhode Island newspaper, they already have an astronomy columnist who actually is the astronomer who Lovecraft kind of gets a lot of his, maybe not quite mentoring, but early access to the Brown University Ladd Observatory from. Lovecraft's also somehow writing an astronomy a column for a newspaper in North Carolina, which, again, you don't tend to associate, you know, Lovecraft with the Appalachians, but he has this Asheville, North Carolina newspaper he's writing about. He, you know, as a teenager and, you know, an early 20s young man, he's writing these diatribes against astrology. And, you know, he has this very funny back and forth with an astrologer in a Providence newspaper. And he takes on the persona of a rival astrologer, and the other astrologer is not really sure how to, you know, respond to this. He, like, I'm sure we'll get into this. He didn't, what today we would say, you know, he debunks a UFO sighting as I think a 20 something, no, he, yeah, as a 20-year-old, he's involved with that. And, you know, you mentioned he's writing this amateur Rhode Island Journal of Astronomy. And in one of his early letters, Lovecraft talks about how he is very interested in science, but for him, science essentially is astronomy. Hippocampus Press has a volume of Lovecraft's nonfiction writings on science. Almost all of these are from his, you know, teenage or early 20s years. Almost all of these are astronomy. So really, his interest in science is essentially synonymous with his interest in astronomy. It's from a very young age, and he's, you know, relatively serious about this. I mean, this is a, you know, a pretty comprehensive, a pretty well-maintained amateur journal, especially for, you know, someone who was a teenager at the time. Those who are interested, Brown University, their John Hay Library has these all digitized. You can look them, you know, online for free. It's, you know, no subscription necessary. It's worth, you know, browsing through, because through this you really get a good cross section of what late 19th, early 20th century astronomy was like, but also, you know, guides for amateur astronomers. He kept meticulous records. He illustrated what he was viewing. It's a very impressive feat.
You're making me wonder about, you know, this idea that during his own lifetime, our conception of what the universe was went from, you know, about the size of the Milky Way to, you know, a vastly more cosmically sized a thing. And so, you know, with what we now call Lovecraft's cosmic fiction, the idea that the universe is endless and vast and uncaring and, you know, wide and empty and you know, the just the sheer size of it makes a mockery of, you know, our human attempts to, you know, create to turn the universe into something friendly and warm, as we do in religions. And I suppose one of the things that's well known about him is that he might be what we now call a skeptic when it comes to, you know, many weird or 14 things. And you've alluded to a story there where he debunks it's like a scare ship in his hometown. Would you tell that story? Because this is fantastic.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you may have done some episodes on this. If not, I'm sure, you know, listeners are probably familiar with mystery airships, phantom airships, which, you know, an early incarnation of what we would call, well, I was going to say what we would call UFOs. So I guess we have to say what we would call UAPs today. But, you know, these are these strange objects flying through the sky. In really the big waves in the United States are 1896 through 97, 1909 through 1910. These are kind of the big wave sightings. And typically, and not all the time, but typically these are not attributed to aliens. They're usually attributed to, you know, eccentric inventors. Again, you know, this is the era of Thomas Edison, the Wright brothers. So again, when people see these strange lights in the sky, they figure this must be some, you know, reclusive, you know, genius, you know, inventor embodying, you know, the American spirit, building some new airship flying around. And so again, you know, that's the general context. So there are people in some of these cases who do think that these ships are, you know, from another planet. Also, people who claim they come from the Hollow Earth, people who claim, no, these are from the Lost Tribes of Israel. So a good, you know, interesting cross-section. I think there's room for someone to write a good book about the phantom airships, I think. But one of these sightings, again, late 1909, early 1910, this ship that was flying around New York, southern New England, was claimed to be an airship invented by a guy named Wallace Tillinghast, who's an inventor in Worcester, Massachusetts, kind of in the central area of the state. Lovecraft is out, you know, shopping Christmas Eve. Again, he's putting off his Christmas shopping until, you know, the night before, but he's in downtown Providence with a bunch of other shoppers on Christmas Eve. They all look up, you know, see this bright light in the sky. Everyone assumes this is the Tillinghast airship. It's, you know, Lovecraft says, oh, that's actually just the planet Venus. And he writes a letter to the newspaper about this sighting, but also he brings this up throughout his columns throughout the year. He is very worried about how during World War I that, you know, someone could assume that the planet Venus is actually just, you know, a German airship coming to bomb Providence. He writes also about how people earlier had misidentified the planet Mars as as some kind of balloon. So this is, again, very prominent on his mind, the idea that Venus, Mars, Jupiter could be misidentified as a strange, unknown flying object and cause panic, or even just, cause, I guess, a misknowledge of science, basically. Again, he was someone who really didn't, science should be taken seriously. You shouldn't, indulge in nonsense views. And so, again, I think that was probably as important in his mind as the fear that it would cause a mass panic. But yeah, again, we have one of the classic UFO debunker tools. It's just the planet Venus. We have that coming right from Lovecraft's mouth.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I suppose it's one of the ironies of his life that he ended up being so influential, not just on out-and-out fiction, but on, what became Fortiana, which, of course, existed in his day. But, his own ideas about ancient astronauts in his fiction, took on a life of their own in the decades after he passed. And yet, you point out in the book that he is using some out of date and slightly weird ideas about astronomy in his work. He's talking about ether decades after, science has given up on that as an idea. And he's talking about the canals on Mars at a time after which it doesn't no longer seem sensible to believe in such things. So I wonder if you might say a little bit about, let's say, Percival Lowell and his effect on Lovecraft. They met at one point, didn't they?
They did, yeah. So Percival Lowell, for those who don't know, he's often referred to as an astronomer. He's a guy who has no astronomical training. His astronomical training comes from the fact that he's from a very wealthy, very connected Boston family, or called the Boston Brahmins. He's kind of, people who, trace their blood back, to the 17th century, the type of people who would be in a Lovecraft story, essentially. But Lowell, his brother, is actually president of Harvard University, but Percival becomes very fascinated by the idea that, you can map canals on Mars, much less one of them. Lowell's also very interested in mapping, canals on Venus, canals on the moons of Jupiter. He is a big fixation for him. But again, you have this idea from Percival Lowell that Mars is this very ancient world, older than Earth. You have these immense, ancient, far more intelligent creatures than inhabit Earth. They're trying in vain to kind of, sculpt their planet, to prevent the collapse of their ecology, to prevent their extinction. Ultimately, they're not going to succeed that despite being so ancient, despite being so advanced, they're going, they can't, fight back against the forces of nature. You can see how this, perception would be very much of interest to Lovecraft. You can see a lot of echoes of how this might help shape, some of Lovecraft's own views. I know the Elder Things from At the Mountains of Madness, or even the Mego aliens from The Whisperer in Darkness. And again, Lowell goes on these speaking tours across the United States. 1907, he speaks at Brown University. Lovecraft's kind of like mentor figure at Lowell, or at a Ladd Observatory at Brown, introduces, the 17-year-old Lovecraft to Percival Lowell. They shook hands. Lovecraft writes, he talked about, that he wrote an astronomy column also, and he was, terrified that Lowell might have read some of his, writings, which, he then, older Lovecraft remarks probably wasn't the case. But there is this interesting case where if you look at Lovecraft's writings on Lowell, he claims later in life that he never believed, the ideas about canals on Mars. They know he didn't, give Lowell any serious scientific consideration, but his writings from when he's younger, he's very, he definitely does, give very strong consideration. He buys into, at least for some period, that Lowell was right and there were these ancient, canal-building Martians on Mars. And I think part of this is, again, we have this view of, Lovecraft as an antiquarian, Lovecraft as a guy who's rooted in the past. He, as a youth, was very interested in astronomy. So as a youth, he read a lot of what was the cutting edge astronomy, textbooks of the time from the 1880s, from the 1890s. Those are the books he owns. When he's interested in astronomy, when he needs, some bit of detail, he goes back to those 19th century books. It gets to the point where in the 1930s, Lovecraft's, his main source, especially when he's writing, is to go back to these 19th century textbooks. And Lovecraft actually is aware of this. Very near the end of his life, he had a chance to write himself an astronomy textbook. And in his letters, he talks about how he's going to need, you know, to like reacclimate himself to what is now the cutting edge of astronomical knowledge. He talks about, you know, needing to move beyond his 19th century textbooks. Unfortunately, he dies. Again, this is the very end of his life. He dies before he can even begin this project. But it is very interesting, you know, it's very tempting to speculate, you know, if Lovecraft hadn't died, if he had lived even a few years longer, we could have gotten, you know, a 1937, a 1938, you know, astronomy textbook for students written by H.P. Lovecraft. That would have been something very interesting to read, not only, you know, for the obvious, but been curious to see exactly how far Lovecraft was willing to kind of, you know, update himself to kind of, you know, integrate himself with what is, you know, the modern movements as opposed to kind of like the comforting worldview or space view such as it is of his youth.
I wonder whether that would have upped his profile, you know, and given him a higher profile in earlier decades than he actually received in real life. I did get a chuckle in your book where you say that when he meets Lowell, he's worried that Lowell will have read his columns in which he was kind of trashing his views.
yeah.
I enjoyed that. So I grew up reading, you know, Carl Sagan's Cosmos with his wonderful chapter about Mars. That's where I, as a child, I learned about the Percival Lowell and the canals, and I've always been fascinated by it. Well, you write a little bit about the concept of ether and how that was, even though it was an out-of-date idea, Lovecraft made space for it in his fiction. And I suppose one of the conventional wisdoms about Lovecraft is that he wrote about these extraordinary things, but in his personal life, he was always a skeptic. Is this another example where that isn't quite true?
Yeah, again, no, there's some, I think, when it comes to the paranormal, he certainly was a skeptic. Again, there's a lot of stuff written about, you know, him denouncing ghosts, you know, for example, as not being real. And, you know, he's very interested in, you know, the idea that, you know, elf and fairy legends are, you know, memories of Picts or Neanderthals, you know, like the Turanian hypothesis. So when he's willing to reject the outright, say, magical or, you know, paranormal. But when it comes to, you know, ideas that we would today consider pseudoscience, fringe science, at, you know, he's willing to extend scientific credulity to some of these beliefs longer than, you know, they might be accepted elsewhere. And again, I think this is something where Lovecraft has some similarities with, you know, some of the pseudoscientists today, where, you know, just for example, if you read, you know, a lot of cryptozoology authors, you know, the true believers, they're, you know, a lot of them are very studied in science. It's just Victorian era science. Now, there's a certain period beyond, you know, the early 20th century. They don't want to advance their scientific views beyond that. I think there's a bit of that in Lovecraft as well. And again, that's why it would have been interesting if, as time went on, if he had been, you know, willing to confront some of this, you know, reluctance to move, which is, again, ironic that Lovecraft is so reluctant to move beyond kind of Victorian era scientific theories, at least in some cases, considering, you know, he talks a lot about how he hates the Victorians, he hates the Victorian era. So I have thought a bit about how kind of funny that is. But at the same time, you know, Lovecraft does take some cutting edge stances. In At the Mountains of Madness, he talks about continental drift. That's a theory that's really not fully accepted scientifically until 30 years later. So the fact that Lovecraft is kind of willing to take a stance supporting what at the time was itself kind of a fringe theory and now is, you know, I don't think anyone really denies continental. Well, I'll say not many people deny continental drift now. So that is one area where Lovecraft does kind of, you know, take a what we consider a progressive scientific stance.
So listeners, we will get to the science fiction powerhouse that was H.G. Wells and War of the Worlds and the connections to Lovecraft there. But before we do, some listeners may be aware that I think it was the same year that in War of the Worlds is published as a book, 1898, a kind of an unofficial, unauthorized quickie sequel is released by a fellow named Garrett P. Service. And for years, that's the extent I knew about this book. I knew it existed, and I presumed that it had been this, yeah, like a cheap cash-in, an unauthorized ripoff by the sounds of it. And yet, Service turns out to be a more important character than that, and some of what he comes up with in that book has repercussions for Lovecraft's work as well. I wonder if you could say a little bit about him.
Oh, absolutely. Garrett Serviss, he's someone who, again, you know, I always referred to him as an astronomer. Horace pointed out, again, much like Percival Lowell, he actually has no training in astronomy. Maybe he's probably a bit more the scientific mainstream. But again, Serviss is originally a journalist, and he transits into, I think, what we call today a science popularizer. And he becomes a very well-known one as well. I mean, he's essentially, you know, somewhat similar to, like, again, the Carl Sagan of the late 19th, early 20th century. He writes quite a number of astronomy textbooks. He writes astronomy columns. He goes on speaking tours. Actually, I've come across him when he was at Johns Hopkins University being accosted by a local flat Earth figure. So, again, interesting how he keeps having some of these crossovers. But he wrote a number of the astronomy textbooks that Lovecraft owned, that Lovecraft kept going back to. But Serviss was also a science fiction author. And I think his view is he tries to, you know, much like kind of hard science fiction, to use his science fiction works as a way of, you know, exploring scientific theories for his readers. To some degree, that's to some degree, maybe that's evident in Edison's Conquest of Mars, this knockoff of The War of the Worlds that he wrote in 1898, which, again, very quick turnaround. I think it's for the Boston Globe newspaper. But for those who aren't aware of this plot, again, it's, you know, Thomas Edison. And again, the book clearly is very influenced, at least initially, by the mystery airship phenomenon. This is essentially the idea, you know, Thomas Edison actually has been behind the building of these mystery airships. And so when H.G. Wells' Martian invasion happens, it's Thomas Edison who's able to, you know, use these airships to lead an international fleet to go to Mars. And again, not to, you know, spoil things. They commit genocide against the Martians. That's the victory. You know, they bombard the surface and kill all the Martians. So again, for an 1898 book, which actually came out during the Spanish-American War, also, you know, some interesting parallels, you know, there for sure. But despite the fact, you know, this is a very much a, well, not quite a knock, because there are other knockoffs of the War of the Worlds that are, you know, a set true knockoffs. They're basically just, you know, replacing, you know, London with New York City and just reprinting it. This is at least, you know, an original idea. You know, this is something that you don't find a lot in, you know, H.G. Wells' you know, original story. But very jingoistic, very like Edison aid type characterization, such as there is. But you see quite a lot of, you know, tropes emerging for the first time. You know, there are articles written that this is the first time a spacesuit appears in science fiction. Yes. This is the first time the ray gun appears in science fiction. This is the first time you're like an interplanetary space battle. You have fleets of ships fighting each other in space. This is apparently the first time that appears. And this is a very early appearance of the ancient alien idea, where when they go to Mars, they discover that the Martians have visited Earth in the past. The Sphinx is actually a sculpture of a Martian king. So again, you have, you know, these ideas that, you know, Martian aliens had visited Earth in the past, left these, you know, giant sculptures in the desert, been, you know, transmuted into gods by, you know, human worshippers over the years. Very interesting to consider how this may have influenced, Lovecraft, especially because he really did hold Serviss in such high esteem. He talked a lot about having read every work of Serviss. Now, again, this was published in newspapers. It's not compiled in book form until 10 years after Lovecraft's death. Although, interestingly, it's some of Lovecraft's former correspondents who are the first ones to republish it in book form. But we do know Lovecraft does mention it at least in one letter. So we know he was aware of this, even if he doesn't explicitly say, I did find the newspaper, you know, volumes and read this. I think there's a high circumstantial degree we can think he did, especially because we actually do have evidence that at least one other person did find the newspaper publications, kept them on hand, went back to read them over the years. This was Robert Goddard, who was a early rocket scientist, who actually also someone whom Lovecraft is very interested in the career of as well.
Tremendous, yeah. And yes, but the whole publishing world was so wild and woolly in some ways, in which, you know, because this was being done in the US and War of the Worlds was published from in England. And so you have these Americans writing, as you say, updated versions that take place in their local cities. So Let's talk a little bit about Tesla and the communications from Mars and how this might have been something that Lovecraft might have been aware of and might have worked into his fiction as well.
Yeah, again, you know, this is the era, again, of, you know, early radio technology, you know, early developments. In this case, Nikola Tesla has kind of become, you know, become such a big figure in, like, steampunk, like, internet nerd, you know, culture. I think it's a bit of a warning sign now where someone mentions Tesla. I think more than anything else, if someone brings up Nikola Tesla, there's going to be some strange views following that. And, you know, it's wrong to say, you know, not that he wasn't a strange guy in life, but again, you know, he was a great inventor of his own who made a lot of, you know, legitimate inventions, was a pioneer of radio technology. And one of the things that he claimed in the late 1890s, early 1900s, was that his radios were picking up signals that could only have come from intelligent Martians. Again, you know, this is decades before, like, the first serious, like, SETI work by Frank Drake and Carl Sagan, but the idea that you can use radios to pick up signals from other planets, this is widespread at the time. So Tesla, kind of the first person, I think 1899, to bring this up. And again, it's strange to think that the 19th century, people are claiming their radios can pick up alien signals. It's, again, debated what exactly he was picking up. Probably it was the radiation belt around Jupiter, but in any case, we can say probably not actually Martians. But again, this is taken seriously enough that in 1924, the U.S. Navy actually conducts like a radio silence day where they try to get people to stop using their radios for a day so that the Navy can try and listen for radio signals from space. Again, you know, 1924, a committed U.S. government effort to, you know, seriously try to listen for radio signals from aliens. We don't tend to really think about, you know, this. Again, today, if, you know, the government tried to do this, probably would be a lot more difficult to even convince them to try, probably a lot more pushback. But it goes to show that, again, things like, again, radio communication with aliens, we tend to think this as, you know, very modern, at 1960s at the earliest, but it goes back decades. It's one of these things that's not only happening, but it's being taken seriously during Lovecraft's lifetime.
So one of the interesting things about Lovecraft is that he's just an incredible fan of the material that of the genre that he's writing in, and he's a real critic. And so, for example, I know I'm one of many fans over the years who have learned about lots of other weird fiction writers through his famous essay, Supernatural Horror in Literature, which still holds up as, I think, as a work of criticism and is well worth a read. But in your book, you talk about another work of his, Some Notes on Interplanetary Fiction. I wonder if you could say a bit about that. What were Lovecraft's ideas about the state of science fiction during his life? What did he approve of? What did he not approve of?
Of course, yeah. So, yeah, Supernatural Horror and Literature. I mean, that's a great essay. Probably the best known nonfiction thing that Lovecraft wrote. Probably even including his fiction, one of the better known things that he's written. I mean, personally, that's one of the very first things of any sort of Lovecraft's I read. Came packaged together with a copy of At the Mountains of Madness, so made it easier for that. Some Notes on Interplanetary Fiction is much shorter. It's much less well known. You know, it was first published, I think it was written for, I believe, an amateur journal that may not have actually come out. And so it's, you know, held back and kind of edited a bit over the years. So it's much shorter. But again, it's kind of like a list of gripes about the state of, you know, what we would today call, I guess, space opera or, space travel fiction. He called it interplanetary fiction, where, again, you know, it tends to be, even at the time, he's talking about how anytime you have interplanetary fiction, it's, you know, some muscular Earthman goes to Mars, you know, rescues, you know, like a conveniently human-shaped Martian princess who tends to be, you know, pretty much, you know, naked, if not, you know, in a golden bikini, and, you know, very buxom, and you have, you know, a fight with a warlord, and then, you know, the Earthman marries the Martian princess. Again, you know, like the trope that, you know, really, you know, is attributed to Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, John Carter of Mars, which Lovecraft did read those books as a kid. He liked them, then kind of revised his views on Burroughs later in life, I think, as many people who enjoyed Burroughs as a kid might have. or read some of his later works might have. I think he didn't have a great later output, maybe. But so Lovecraft, you know, basically says, you know, you shouldn't use, you know, humanoid aliens. You need to have aliens would be actually alien in appearance, but also actually alien in behavior. You need to pay attention to the latest science. You need to make sure, you know, if you're mentioning, you know, some star, you need to make sure that, you know, that star would actually be rising. If you're on a, you know, a planet beyond the solar system, you know, you can't have the same constellations. You need to keep in mind, you know, the rotational periods of planets, their gravity. And so, again, you know, he's basically an advocate for what we would call hard science fiction today, which, again, somewhat, you know, funny considering that his few forays into science, into what we might call pure science fiction, not quite hard. But he himself is a strong advocate. He thinks most of the genre of his time is substandard, we'll say. But again, he supports H.G. Wells. He thinks that Olaf Stapledon, who probably his best known book even today, Last and First Men. Again, someone who in the 1930s, much more, I think, widely known even amongst science fiction fans than he is today. One of Lovecraft's really strong authors he supported was Stanley Weinbaum, who an author who had some similarities to Lovecraft. Again, he starts writing, you know, short stories basically out of nowhere in the early 1930s, has a very brief career, then dies very young from cancer suddenly. Again, very similar to Lovecraft's own trajectory, but much more condensed. Stanley Weinbaum wrote a series of stories set in this like fantastical version of the solar system, but one that is hewing very close to the science of his time. He has, you know, aliens that are truly alien in appearance. He's very interested in kind of fleshing out the, I guess, the cartography of his solar system and the planets there. I mean, again, I think Weinbaum probably not very well remembered today, but those stories, they're worth, they hold up. I mean, I really enjoyed them. Arthur C. Clarke talks about how Weinbaum was a very strong influence of him. Now, for example, in 2001, A Space Odyssey, the scene when Dave Bowman gets ejected from the pod into the airlock, you know, without a suit on, that's explicitly taken from one of Stanley Weinbaum's stories that, you know, Arthur C. Clarke very openly admitted just to copying because he liked that concept so much. So there is, again, you know, a lot of people at the even though we tend to think, you know, science fiction, space opera in the 20s and 30s of mainly being dreck and Lovecraft, you know, certainly agree there was a lot of dreck. There are a lot of gems at the time, too, and a lot of people who are doing stuff that Lovecraft approves of.
You know, just speaking of truly alien aliens, if anyone's wondering how the kind of octopoid Martians of War of the Worlds might have influenced or been an influence on the Sphinx in Egypt, it's worth mentioning that in Garrett Serviss's book, the Thomas Edison Conquers Mars, he completely dispenses with Wells's idea of what the Martians look like and makes them into humanoids, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, they look kind of like giant ogres, but yeah, which again, it's interesting, you know, I wonder if, you know, Serviss had kind of been commissioned to start writing it even before,
yes.
Again, initially War of the Worlds is serialized, so I wonder if he was just basically, you know, working out of those early chapters, and then there also seems to be some, you know, confusion as to whether the Martian tripods are the Martians themselves or just a machine. Lovecraft, at one point, he kind of, makes that kind of a mistake in one of his letters, I think, when he's comparing the planetarium projector of the Hayden Planetarium in New York to one of his friends, where he seems, you know, to confuse the Martian machines with the Martians themselves. But yeah, again, it is very strange that, you know, I think, you know, the octopus Martians are very distinctive, and they are kind of not done great justice by Garrett Serviss. Although I will say I did recently rewatch the 1953 War of the Worlds adaptation by George Powell. They completely, you know, they have very different Martians as well in that. But I think those Martians come across, you know, you can revise them. It's just you have to do them interestingly. And a giant ogre, not quite that interesting. Also, doesn't quite equate to the Sphinx either, if you think about it. So I'm not quite sure what was going on in Serviss's mind then.
Oh, I'm a big fan of the George Powell film. Absolutely love that version. Yeah, it's completely different in so many ways, and it works. And the the craft, alien craft, are updated in a way to look like flying saucers of a sort, you know, with lip service paid to the tripod legs with the energy ribbons. I really love that. But all this makes me think, do you know Bat Durston is the name, is a derogatory name for space westerns where, you know, writers aren't really using, you know, they're not really exercising their imagination to come up with truly alien aliens. And I just had something at the back of my head, so I looked it up there. It's from Galaxy magazine in 1950, which obviously was a science fiction magazine. And it was an ad in which they contrasted a paragraph of writing from a Western with a paragraph of writing from, you know, a 1950s science fiction story. And it's the exact same, except the nouns are different. And then at the bottom it says, they're both starring this kind of faux Western character called Bat Durston. And at the bottom it says, sound alike? They should. One is merely a Western transplanted to some alien and impossible planet. If this is your idea of science fiction, you're welcome to it. You will never find it in Galaxy.
Well, I mean, I think even in some notes in interplanetary fiction, Lovecraft says, you know, like, you know, you shouldn't just have, you know, your space opera be a term, you know, playing like cowboys and Indians, but on Mars. Again, you know, he's making that direct connection there. And actually, you know, in a lot, you know, I guess to bring the frontier metaphor, and, you know, speaking of the frontier, Star Trek with the Final Frontier, Gene Roddenberry originally conceives it as Wagon Train to the Stars.
The stars,
and actually, I forget if it was Arthur C. Clarke or Stanley Kubrick, one of them, you know, their original pitch for 2001 was How the Solar System Was Won, you know, again, comparing it to How the West Was Won. So you do have these, but in one of his nonfiction books, Percival Lowell does talk about how, you know, like, only someone who's situated, you know, like the astronomical temples of the Wild West, you know, can really fully understand the environment of Mars. And I think that's a little bit of a dig on, you know, like the academics back in Eastern universities calling him, you know, unkind names for his ideas about Martian canals. But he's, you know, embodying that, you know, the Western frontier, which in, you know, 1894, when Lowell Observatory is opened, it's in Flagstaff, Arizona. That's only 4 years after the formal closing of the Western frontier. So this idea that you have to be enmeshed in, you know, the Western frontier with the deserts, with, at the time as it was conceived, the Native Americans as this dying civilization, you know, clearly Lowell's directly saying, unless you're in that environment, you can't truly comprehend what Mars is like, and you can't really, you know, fully understand, you know, what you're viewing at Mars through the telescope. Again, to what degree he may actually have believed that, I mean, I think he probably did, but also, again, works as a very convenient way of deflecting criticism from, you know, the ivory tower astronomers, like his brother, and he's a not too much of an underdog in this story. But
that's the desert Mars with the dying civilization, like that's Wells Mars, that's Lowell's Mars, but it's also Ray Bradbury's Mars in a slightly different way. In the 1950s.
And yeah, in the Martian Chronicles, Lovecraft is mentioned. He's actually in one chapter that got excised, or not him, but like a ghost of Lovecraft kind of appears. And honestly, you know, thinking back, reading the Martian Chronicles as a kid, that mention of Lovecraft, that probably was my first connection to Lovecraft. But Ray Bradbury, he got his start, you know, publishing stuff through Arkham House, the publishing house that's set up by Lovecraft's friends to publish Lovecraft's work after his death. I think Bradbury's first book is put out through Arkham House. I think he wrote some stuff for the Arkham Sampler. So again, Bradbury has this very close connection with kind of the Lovecraftian legacy.
I'm nearly certain that I first heard his name in a Bradbury story. And I think it was either Usher 2, which is the one which is set on Mars, or it might have been, there's a story where a guy comes back to life in a future world where all bodies are incinerated, and he kind of represents like this, the horror genre, which has been pushed underground. And he mentions Edgar Allan Poe and he mentions Lovecraft. And for a long time, it just lodged in my head as a weird name. And I never, I didn't know what Ray Bradbury was referring to.
I mean, yeah, in the 1950s, that would have been a time when Lovecraft's fandom was not that great compared to, you know, at the end of his life or like it is today. So again, a sign that Bradbury was kind of, you know, one of the diehard Lovecraft fans.
if we switch tack a little bit to talk about movies, I have this conception that Lovecraft was a bit snobbish about movies in general, which you can correct me if I'm wrong there. But when I was a kid, I read about a film that had been lost and destroyed called Woman in the Moon, 1929. And I knew it was a German film. And I read that it was so realistic in its depiction of space flight that the German government wanted it destroyed. And I've found out from reading your book that this was Fritz Lang and that Willy Ley was involved. Willy Ley, known for connections to science fiction and also cryptozoology.
Yeah, so yeah, Willy Ley is part of the early like pre-Nazi German rocket program. The acronym is VFR. I can't tell you what it means in German, but that's the name of the organization. This, again, you know, the famous group with, you know, members like Hermann Oberth, Werner von Braun. Mm. This is the group that after the Nazis come to power, you know, gets incorporated into the V2 program. Willy Ley is, you know, among that group. He makes the decision to escape the Nazis. So, again, the people who say, oh, we had no choice but to work with the Nazis. There's evidence that's not the case. But in the 1920s, again, you know, Fritz Lang, director of Metropolis, he makes this movie. It's worth watching. Again, you know, it has like things like, you know, a countdown before a blast off, has a two-stage rocket that's very rare. It does have kind of like one pseudoscience idea, the idea that's promoted by a Danish astronomer named Peter Andreas Hansen, that the far side of the moon, maybe it's kind of deformed a bit, so that even though there's no air on the side of the moon we see, maybe it's all kind of gathered in a pocket on the far side of the moon. So the rocket lands there so they can walk around on the moon without a spacesuit. Interestingly, Lovecraft says as a very young kid, he wrote a science fiction story based on Jules Verne about people going to the moon, landing in, you know, the air pocket on the Hansen theory on the far side. So again, Lovecraft, again, coming up with the same idea that Fritz Lang used. Unfortunately, Lovecraft said, you know, this story is long gone. I would have killed to read that just out of curiosity. But again, you know, like von Braun, the V2 program, they're very much influenced by Woman in the Moon. I've heard, I can't verify this 100%, I've heard that, you know, they would put a like Woman in the Moon like nose cone art on some of the V2s. In any case, you know, this is a very, you know, early, very realistic for its time, like rocket exploration movie, space exploration movie. And again, of note, you know, Willy Ley comes to the U.S. Fritz Lang also comes to the U.S. Fritz Lang read huge numbers of, you know, Amazing Stories, Galaxy, Weird Tales. The issues he had, again, according to Willy Ley, and which Ley sold after, you know, Fritz Lang moved on, indicates that Fritz Lang and Willy Ley read a lot of Lovecraft stories. I mean, almost certainly they read, you know, assuming they're actually reading the full volumes that they were buying, or the full issues they were buying, they read almost all of Lovecraft's published stories, which again is very interesting. Now, that would have been after they came to the U.S., so it wouldn't be a direct influence on A Woman in the Moon. But a lot of the stuff that Willy Ley went on to work on with cryptozoology, with science fiction development. Again, Willy Ley became friends with Arthur C. Clarke, who also was a youthful Lovecraft fan. Werner von Braun, again, assuming he actually read the issues of Amazing Stories that were shipped to him to Germany through the Swedish embassy, he at least would have read At the Mountains of Madness, The Shadow Out of Time. So you have these figures very big in both early science fiction, but also early space travel, early cryptozoology. Almost all of them, you know, are these three figures, four if you include Clark, absolutely must have read Lovecraft. In some cases, almost all of Lovecraft's published work must have been read by them at some point.
Those are astonishing connections. You know, I really struggle to explain to people how influential Lovecraft must have been and how core, you know, for a guy who seems fairly obscure to, outsiders, people who are not into pulp fiction of a certain era. You know, his ideas have fanned out far and wide and made their way through really mainstream pop culture, you know, at one step removed from himself.
I mean, yes, I think this is part of the reason why Lovecraft, you know, has kind of developed a legacy that's only grown with time. You know, there's other factors also. if anyone's interested, S.T. Joshi published a book a couple years ago called, I think it's The Reception of H.P. Lovecraft, which looks at his literary reception over the years. Lovecraft, in many ways, was his own worst enemy. He could have done a lot more to publicize himself as an author, to be more successful as an author. So Lovecraft was his own worst enemy. Probably his second biggest enemy was August Derleth, who kind of took over Lovecraft's legacy and kind of sabotaged some attempts to popularize Lovecraft, moving forward. But again, these are themes that are, really resonant, that despite, his terrible sense of publicity, his real unwillingness to, promote himself, these ideas have only continued to grow and grow. Even when I kind of first got into, Lovecraft, maybe like 25 years ago, it was still a fairly fringe thing. You might see like one occasional reference here and there in, comics or novels. And now you can't escape Lovecraft. It's ever, even if it's, again, just, using his name, using Cthulhu and somewhere. But the underlying premises of these is really so evocative and very much ahead of his time as well. Speaking of influences from magazines, one thing I learned about only after finishing this book, and I would like to come back to this at some point in the future, one other person who almost certainly read early Lovecraft was Donald Kehoe, an early flying saucer researcher, because Kehoe, before he got into flying saucer research in the 40s and 50s, he also published in Weird Tales, including issues with Lovecraft's own writing in them as well. So we, again, assuming Kehoe actually read Weird Tales, which is a good bet considering he published it, he absolutely would have read a lot of these Lovecraft stories about, aliens visiting the Earth. And so you have one of the very first people shaping flying saucer lore as we understand it, clearly having read Lovecraft. I think there's a lot to unpack there. Again, it's one of the things that kills me. I didn't realize it enough time to put it in the book. But no, at some point, I'll have to write more about this in the future.
That's an incredible connection. Oh my goodness, that's a whole different direction we could take it in.
I know.
One thing I do want to talk about is there's been a bit of a fashion in the last 10 years for like kind of nostalgia science fiction about old versions of old visions of solar system science fiction. So I'm sure you're aware of the, and in fact, I think you referenced it in the book, the collections that were called Old Mars and Old Venus came out recently. And I bet you've read the S.M. Sterling stories about the old fashioned type Mars and Venus that came out in, maybe 20.
Yep. Yep. So the Sky People is the Venus one. And then it's the Courts of the Crimson King.
Yes.
Something like that. Yeah.
Those books are good fun.
Oh, yeah.
So Lovecraft wrote at least one short story set on what we might now call Old Venus, the old fashioned idea that Venus could have been a place where it was swampy. It had dinosaurs living on it. It had reptile people living on it, that sort of thing. Where does that idea come from? And how come Lovecraft used it this one time? And there's just something about that idea which is kind of not Lovecraft to me. So I'm interested to find out how that story came to be written.
So the idea of this in the Walls of Eryx, it was approached to him. The idea was not from Lovecraft. It was from one of, he had a lot of these young proteges that surround him, a guy named Kenneth Sterling, who was a teenager who lived in Providence, who was a fan of Lovecraft's. He realized, Lovecraft, right around the corner. So he went up and just introduced himself to this author he really liked. And they collaborated on a story together. Interestingly, even though he was a teenager at the time, I don't know exactly how old, he had written at least one story beforehand, which is one of the very first stories set on Pluto. So again, very early in the game. But Sterling came up with this idea of, a story set on Venus. He wrote an initial draft. Lovecraft almost completely, rewrote it and expanded it by 50% more. So most of what is there is from Lovecraft, even though the core ideas, we don't know exactly how much, but the core ideas there are from Kenneth Sterling. But the general idea of, that Venus would be swampy, would be covered in, dinosaurs. This comes from the same kind of cosmological idea that was why Mars was assumed to be much older, that this early conception of the formation of the solar system is that the primeval solar nebula condensed from the outside, and the nebula cools off, so you get planets condensing from the outside. So the outermost planets are older, the innermost planets are younger. So if Mars is an older version of Earth, it makes sense that Venus would be a primeval version of Earth. So you get things like cavemen or dinosaurs, or primitive life, just as it makes sense that Mars is full of ancient, highly evolved life. And if Mars is dying, then Venus is lush and vibrant in comparison. So again, this is kind of the same ecology of or cosmology, I guess, of ideas that is influencing a lot of these notions of Martian life that we've talked about. And so, Lovecraft, if he's writing a story set on Venus at the time, of course he's going to incorporate these ideas. Although, again, even despite the fact that at the time, the idea that, Venus was comparable to Earth in terms of temperature, in terms of atmosphere, professional astronomers by this point kind of already knew that wasn't the case. But, the wider public, and especially the science that Lovecraft was following, that would have been still taken as a possibility for Venus to have kind of like a tropical, very humid, but generally Earth-like atmosphere.
So I actually really like the story. I always have. It on the surface, it is very kind of 1930s pulp, and it's a tiny little bit Bat Durston in terms of like there's prospectors on Venus, and they might as well be prospectors in the Old West. And yet there's this slightly, you could interpret it as being a kind of an anti-colonial vibe to it, where, the humans are punished for in a really interesting, entertaining and creative way. The central character is punished for, getting into the Venusuvians' territory and taking their resources. And if this is one that people haven't read, I recommend tracking it down. It's good fun. But as you point out in the book, there's not been that much written about this. It's not generally a part of, the canon that's examined of Lovecraft's work, perhaps because it was, did you write that it's his final story or one of his final stories?
It might be his final story written. I believe so. Yeah.
And it just has a kind of a pulpy silliness to it that is a bit different to how we think about Lovecraft. We think that his work is very serious and very dour. And this one, on the surface at least, seems a bit like it's more like a C.L. Moore story or something like that, cowboys in space a little bit. But absolutely worth tracking down. And I've always enjoyed it. I've saved the heaviest subject for last. So for me, a huge looming presence in all of these discussions about astronomy, about space, about Mars, and about science fiction is, of course, H.G. Wells and his absolutely singular War of the Worlds. And there's a magnificent chapter in your book about Lovecraft's relationship with Mars, predicated on the idea that he barely mentions Mars at all. And so you have to look a little bit deeper for the connections and for the ways in which writing and fiction about Mars influenced his work. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about H.G. Wells and Lovecraft's attitude towards about him, and work us around to the influence on Mountains of Madness, in particular, my absolute favorite Lovecraft work.
Absolutely, yeah. So again, for like a five, six year period in the late 1890s, up to 1901, this is, he writes, he invents, so many of the tropes we have today, including the alien invasion, the time machine, the word or the phrase time machine comes from him. I mean, again, hard to discount him as being such a pioneering figure. But one thing that I think tends to be forgotten today, from the 1920s kind of up until his death, he basically reinvented himself as a nonfiction author, as like a public intellectual. I mean, he's going to the Soviet Union to interview Lenin during the Russian Revolution. He's writing these monumental works of history. He's writing these biology textbooks with Julian Huxley. So again, Lovecraft's, a lot of his fiction is coming from a time when H.G. Wells is, and his scientific speculation, his speculation on the development of civilizations, is taken very seriously, I think, in ways that aren't, probably don't link. There's a reason why we remember him for like his 1890s fiction, not his 1920s guides to economics, or frankly his 1920s fiction, which I think in general, the stuff after maybe like 1905 doesn't quite hold up all that well. And I say this as a big H.G. Wells fan as well. There's definitely a sharp decline, I think. But, you know, he's earned the reputation from those early years, absolutely. But, you know, you go to At the Mountains of Madness, you know, this expedition to this remote part of the world. It's, you know, a climate that's, you know, completely inhospitable. It requires special ships to get there. You know, there's radio broadcasts back home. This is very similar, you know, to a space expedition. It's a space expedition, except set in the most inhospitable, distant part of the Earth. And that's not a coincidence either, because if you read some of Lovecraft's comments, it is very clear that he originally wrote, or the original idea for At the Mountains of Madness was going to be what he called an interplanetary story. And then very quickly in its development, obviously he turns it into an Antarctica story. But again, kind of the seed of a space expedition is there from the start. But there's also this kind of parallel thing where Lovecraft explicitly was modeling his Antarctic expedition on the U.S. Navy Antarctic expedition led by Admiral Byrd. Again, this is not the same expedition where, you know, where he goes into the Hollow Earth and meets the Aryan, Hollow Earth aliens of, you know, later conspiracy theories. But Byrd had expeditions before then. The later Byrd expeditions were major influences on Wernher von Braun's early Mars mission planning. So basically our conception of a Mars mission draws from the same Arctic or Antarctic expeditions that Lovecraft was modeling his expedition on. So you have this kind of like two-way connection there. Excuse me. But at the same time, from the H.G. Wells connection, again, the idea of, you know, this dying civilization trying to hold back, the onset of the collapse of their environment. You can see how this is very interesting to Lovecraft. Even though the very non-human depictions of the Martians, again, if you look at depictions of other aliens at the time, they're humanoid. You know, look at Dejah Thoris from John Carter. Definitely, you know, the Wells Martians are much closer to Cthulhu and the Elder Things than, the humanoid, you know, space opera Martians are. But also, interestingly enough, Lovecraft claims later in life he never fully read The War of the Worlds until I think he would have been in his 20s or 30s. But even though he says that in a later letter, I do have to question that because, again, he makes comments to it much earlier in his life. He has a very vivid dream that is clearly taken from The War of the Worlds. So either he read an annotated version, he read a newspaper reprinting or something like that. But again, that is very interesting that he would claim he never read War of the Worlds until later in life. But there's very clear evidence he's at least very familiar with the story earlier on.
In reference to something you said earlier, I had access to just one or two chapters of War of the Worlds as a young person before I had access to the entire book. And I had a chapter in a collection of stories by James Blish, or chosen by James Blish, so it was like chapters of old, out of date, out of copyright science fiction. And yeah, the tripods are referred to as the Martians. And so, yeah, for many years I was unsure as to whether the tripods were the Martians themselves.
Yeah, and actually, you know, speaking of James Blish, he was a very late correspondent with Lovecraft before Lovecraft died. And I think Blish, he went on to write the very first Star Trek novels, I believe. So again, kind of one of the ways in which you have the cosmic, you know, science fiction of Lovecraft transitioning into kind of, you know, the preeminent science fiction today, at least one of the preeminent major science fiction series today.
So I'll take things to a close unless you have any final thoughts. But the book is When the Stars Are Right, H.P. Lovecraft and Astronomy by Edward Guimont and Horace A. Smith. It's from Hippocampus Press, in case you can't tell. I absolutely think that listeners are going to love it. It's absolutely chock full of the stuff we've been talking about. There are so many connections to all the greats of science fiction and all of the history of astronomy and there's so much more that we could have got into. Is there anything that you'd like people to know about the book, or anything we didn't cover that you think they should know is in the book?
Oh, well, too much. I mean, really, it's just, this was a real labor of love. I mean, this is the kind of thing where, you know, I would work on this after a full day of, you know, teaching and grading, and that can take a lot out of you. So hopefully when people read this, they can, you know, they can see the energy, they can see the enthusiasm there. But again, I was somewhat joking earlier, promoting it earlier, but I do think, you know, this is it's a biography, it's a literary history, it's a history of science. If you're interested in kind of any of these topics of science fiction, of Lovecraft, of astronomy, of notions of cosmology, I think people will find something of interest out of all of this. And I think it does go to show how fiction, how science can have an influence on each other, you know, over the decades, something I know has been a recurring theme on this podcast.
Absolutely. So where would you like people to find yourself and your work online?
Oh, my God. I'm still perpetually working on the website. For now, I'm still available through X, the Everything app, as we have to call it now. not super active there, but I do at least maintain my account. I mean, you know, people can find me. For those who are more academically oriented, you can find my ORCID account, or you can reach out. You'll find a way to reach out to me. I'm not too difficult to find. I will say I do have two upcoming projects I am very excited about. The first with Richard Fallon, I know past guest.
Yes.
We are co-editing a volume of an issue rather of the journal Interdisciplinary Science Reviews on the topic of heterodox paleoscience. So how kind of like fringe ideas of the past have become mainstream, or vice versa, in both science and fiction. We have some great work in that issue. Justin Mullis, I know, who's been on the show, but he has an issue in that an article in that coming out. Again, we're covering, there's issues covering Jurassic Park, covering the Creation Museum in Kentucky, covering Japanese cryptozoology. J.R.R. Tolkien is in there. So again, I think people who are, you know, fans of this podcast will be very interested in that issue. That should be coming out, I think, by the middle of this year, if not beforehand. But again, very long process, but we're near the end of that. And on a bit of a longer time, so I will say, after a lot of effort, I have formally signed the contract for my Flat Earth book. It is now called The Power of the Flat Earth Idea: History from the Marginalized. It probably will be out late 2025, early 2026 from Palgrave Macmillan. Again, very excited to work on that. That's a similar labor of love to this. Lovecraft, he has a few cameo appearances in that book. I can't say a lot, but he has some cameo appearances. Garrett Service shows up there. So again, I can't say if you love Lovecraft, you'll love that Flat Earth book, but the odds are you probably will. So probably should make sure to remind yourself to buy a few copies anyway.
That sounds tremendous. Thank you so much, Eddie. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, that's it for this episode. Hopefully you enjoyed that. Obviously, we could have taken that conversation in many, many more directions. Hopefully this is one of those episodes about which people tend to say, you know, that one gave me a lot of new things to find and new books to read and new creators to seek out, as is the case for myself always when talking to someone who knows this much about the topic. One small note, which is that I went searching for Fritz Lang's Woman in the Moon, and I've always, since childhood, had this idea that the film was either lost or deliberately destroyed. I'm not sure why that is. It is available on YouTube. It's about 3 hours long, which is a lot of 1920s silent movie for watching these days, but it is worth scrubbing through and looking at the outer space sequences, as they are pretty impressive for the time. So as always, folks, reach out on the socials as usual, or say thanks over at buymeacoffee.com/White Atlantic. And until next time, stay safe and thanks for listening.
We are certain that Satanism exists. It's the practice of evil.
And following closely behind this car was this unidentified flying object.
You prove the existence of the Bigfoot or Sasquatch by